You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the success strategies and the secrets of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business. I'm excited for today's guest. Garrett Gunderson is the founder and chief wealth architect of Wealth Factory, and he is the New York Times best-selling author of Killing Sacred Cows. Oh, no. Overcoming the financial myths that are destroying your prosperity. He's also personally helped countless business owners create efficient wealth strategies that fit their unique strengths. So, Garrett, I'm excited to welcome you to Making Bank today.
I'm glad you got the name of the book right. I was once on a podcast. They call it Killing Scared Crows. I was like, damn, that just sounds mean. You know,
I almost said that. I had a pause in my head for a minute.
Yeah.
So. Well, yeah, no, awesome. I'm excited today. I know we've bumped into each other often and on here over the last, I think, year or so. Excited to actually finally be able to get you on the show and pick your brain and understand, you know, as entrepreneurs, you know, what we can do as myself and our listeners, just, you know, by creating more efficient strategies and everything for our financial plans. But I guess first, give me a little bit of background kind of on who you are and how you got started down this path.
Well, I grew up in this small coal mining town. I mean, it's so small that I took some friends there because we were out at this concert in Colorado and we were driving back through Utah. And I'm like, oh, where I live is just 8 miles down that road where I grew up. And they're like, whatever. I'm like, you guys want to see it? So I'm driving them through. They're like, dude, you didn't live here. And out walks this girl, Amanda McFarland. And I'm like, Amanda. She's like, Garrett. I'm like, see, that was my neighbor. And they're like, no way, man. So, but yeah, I mean, my dad was a coal miner, my grandfather's, my great grandfather's. But, you know, when I was a kid, I used to just kind of mow lawns. That was kind of my basic mode of making money until I was 15. And my dad, being a coal miner, brought home these surface vehicles. When the bosses would come in town, clean them up, I started helping him. My mom worked at a credit union. They'd repossess vehicles. I went to the president, started detailing those cars, and I launched the most brilliantly named company, Garrett Gunderson's Car Care. It took me a long time to think of that one, but 15 years old, I launched that. I won third place for the Rural Young Entrepreneur of the Year that year. The next year, I won first place, and then I won the SBA Young Entrepreneur of the Year when I was 17 years old for 30 and under. I didn't win it again, and it would be you know, until 30 and under, but I won it when I was 17 at least.
That's really cool. That's awesome. And so you had the car detail business the whole time, all the way through.
Just till I went to college. I actually, in June of 1998, started working in financial services when I was a sophomore in college, which, Josh, like, this is what financial services really meant. Hey, bring your family and friends into our firm so we can peddle them insurance and mutual funds. And, you know, I did that until the year 2000. And then when the market started going down, I actually went to all my clients and told them, hey, I don't really know what the hell I'm doing. I'm just handing this money off to someone else. You should get out because I don't know how long it's going to last. And by May of 2000, all but one of my clients was out of the market. And in 2001 and 2002, we did 44% and 41%, which positive returns in years when it was down, by using one strategy where they're out of the market 80%+ of the time. And it totally changed my thinking around money, investing, and everything.
And that's interesting because, like you said, so many people it's like, hey, you know, yeah, get in this mutual fund, do this. And I mean, for myself, when I was in high school, I was in the, I don't know if, how old are you?
I'm 38. 38, right?
Okay.
38.
So just turned 44 last month. And so there was the USA Today AT&T Investment Challenge when I was in school. And so I ended up investing and winning like first out of like 25,000 people, and you know, a couple of years in a row, and we actually had a really cool investing class in my school, and the teacher was real passionate about it, so it was really fun to be around that. So I've always invested on and off over the years until, and then put it all in the .coms, and then leveraged that, and then lost it all.
Well, dude, what was cool is when I was in college, the professor that helped me get all my clients' money out of the stock market, his name is Stephen Harrop. He managed $5 billion in muni bond funds, decided to retire and become a professor. I was a senator at the school, so I met him. became friends. We started playing racquetball together, and he donated, I don't know how many millions to the school, but I had a group with three other guys where we managed $250,000 of the school's money, and we had to beat our benchmarks to get an A in the class. It was actually one of our courses called Investments 2, and we took second. One person invested in oil and crushed everyone, and then we took second, so I got a B-plus in that class because it was graded on the curve. A, if you win, B, all the way down to, hey, the team that does the worst, they don't pass the class. It was crazy.
That's cool, though. It's awesome that he did that, and it helped inspire, and it makes it way more fun that way, learning. So
yeah, we kept in touch. I think one of the coolest early moments of my life is he became a client, just on a specific strategy. But I showed him a strategy, and he's like, I like that idea, and he became a client. And it was like the biggest confidence booster for me. As a matter of fact, the only reason I even scheduled the meeting with him is my assistant said, hey, who should I be scheduling with? It was the first day. And I just gave her a list and put his name on there. And she scheduled in a meeting with us. And I was like, hey, I wouldn't have probably had the balls to do it myself, but because she did it, I met with him and he became a client and still is a client to this day, which was really cool because that was back in 1999.
Dang, that's awesome. That's so great. So tell me a little bit about what kind of makes you different compared to what is out there. Because now you see Tony's promoting, with his Money Mastery book and kind of investing in the different indexes. But then I know another good friend of mine who does kind of a similar thing to you has already been, he'd been investing his clients' money that way for a long time. So it wasn't anything new. So I guess what kind of makes what you're doing different and how you've gotten the results for your people?
So we became experts in helping people keep more of what they make. Entrepreneurs have this kind of dilemma where I call it the treadmill dilemma. They think if they run harder and faster, they're going to get further ahead. So they think that revenue is always the answer. And in the world of finance, I was like, well, what about the biggest bills they have? Like the biggest bill they probably have is their tax bill. And super highly affluent people, they have really good family offices that have accountants and attorneys that help them save tax. So I knew that if I could help someone save tax, that was a guaranteed return. If I could help them find inefficiencies where they are overpaying on hidden fees and commissions, that was a guaranteed return. Or if I could help them get better interest rates and better structures to their loans, that was guaranteed cash flow in their life. Or if there were duplicate coverages or costs with insurance, that could be money back in their life. And so I abandoned the commission and fee-based model. And I created what I called a tuition-based backed by results model, where we said, you write us a check so you know exactly what you pay us, and we're going to go and help like financial detectives and human ATMs put money back into your life now rather than tell you just to save more. But one of the biggest distinctions is we believe in cash flow investing instead of accumulation. I don't believe in waiting for 30 years hoping that it all works out. I think cash flow is king, and we want cash flow to come in through entrepreneurial income and investment income to cover someone's expenses. And as soon as they do that, they have economic independence, and that is our brand. We want economic independence for people. And that entrepreneurial income doesn't count if someone has to show up to earn the income the next day. They have to still monitor it and manage it and be responsible for it, but it has to come in whether they show up to the office the next day. And investment income is cash flow on a regular basis, so we help people, first of all, boost their profits and keep more of what they make. Second, get really strategic about how they can engineer wealth and find it through efficiency and coordination. Then third, turning on cash flow with their investments. But fourth, here's a big distinction between me and Tony. I believe to become wealthy, you have to be an entrepreneur for 91% of the population. Why? John Bowen put a book out there that said 91% of people worth 5 million or more had one thing in common. They were entrepreneurs. Tony says in his book, it's risky to be an entrepreneur, but it's riskier not to be in today's world in my mind, because things are moving so quick and we're figuring out more efficient ways to replace human beings on some of the labor that in the past required human beings.
And no, I mean, I think you're totally right, especially too. I mean, we have pro entrepreneurial administration now is what it seems to be. And so, that is going to, I think, help drive more opportunities for entrepreneurs, whether it's money or, tax breaks and things like that. So, which is going to probably help you guys help your clients better too, as well, I would think.
For sure. I mean, look, there's so much in the entrepreneurial world of people overpaying tax. 93% is our assessment. 93% of business owners overpay on tax. Part of it is they don't have a methodology. Part of it is they have accountants that are B-teamers at best, and they're not really good at being proactive. Another part of it is when they hit a certain level, they need a tax attorney, not just a CPA. And another piece is just getting their books in order and proactively meeting with their tax team. But I look at three main categories. Number one, business owners need to look to reclassify their income. W-2 income is the highest tax income possible. 1099, 1098, capital gains is a lower tax rate. And so there's ways to shift that income and how people pay themselves. The second thing is that they really need to look at how they can turn their expenses into tax deductions by connecting the story of how it benefits or is utilized by the business. Because a lot of people are afraid to take tax deductions that they don't have to be afraid of. Like paying your kids, I know you know I have two kids, you've got three kids, we can pay our kids, and that's $6,300 that would be tax-free. I can rent out my home. I can rent my home out 14 days a year to my business. That's tax-free income to me personally, but a write-off for the business. There's so many write-offs. I mean, even behind me, I have clothes right here that I write off as a uniform because I don't wear them around the house. I wear them on video and on video podcasting and on stage. And most people won't take that and write that off because accountants say they're conservative, which really means antiquated, lazy, or reactive. And so, you know, those are just a couple ideas right there that can help people out. But the number one way to save tax is you build a tax team and you get proactive. So when you build your tax team, the first thing you do is look back your last 3 years and see, did you overpay your taxes? In 2006, two of my business partners died. I did not meet with my accountants proactively. I didn't get them information. I was chaos. And then 2 years later, I found out I'd overpaid my taxes $54,000 and got an amendment and got the IRS to pay me that money back. So that happens all the time. We've had people get as little as $951 back from amending, but people get as much as $457,000 back from amending their returns. And I wish, Josh, I could tell you it was because I was really brilliant. It was just basic things that were missed, that were black and white, legal and ethical. But anyway, I just went off the diatribe on taxes. Hopefully helpful for the viewers here.
No, I think people need to know and understand that. I know what we've paid our kids, I don't know, probably for the last 3 or 4 years, you know, every year. And, you know, it just goes in their account and stuff that gets invested. And, you know, one of the big things, we thought we were pretty good. And then we found, you know, two things was the renting of the house and also a captive insurance, which is what we're rolling out this year.
That's a big reclassification of income. So captive insurance means you're setting up the C corporation, you're setting up an insurance agency for your business, and money goes into it pre-tax. And if it's not used for a claim in the business, a year later, you can take it out capital gains. That's basically shifting a 40% tax bracket down to a 20% tax bracket. That's a pretty big deal.
Right. I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, there's other things I'm not a huge fan of, but they're worth looking into. I mean, conservation easements are becoming really big right now as tax strategies. It's basically saying, here's land we're never going to develop, and you can buy into that. And then all of a sudden, you get major tax credits because it's not going to be developed or sold. So it's a conservation easement. Or, you know, there's so many tax strategies. Like if you own a building, you can do something called cost segregation with an engineer, which can allow you, rather than waiting somewhere between 29 and 39 years to take your write-offs, start getting some of those write-offs over 3 years and 7 years and 10 years. I mean, I could think of multiple people. This guy, Jim Arnold, that when I was meeting with him, it was $30,000 a year in additional deductions now, rather than waiting for 10, 20 years. So there's so much opportunity there that is part of the tax code. Not even taking it offshore, not having complicated things that require, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars with attorneys and legal things. But I mean, I was just on with my tax attorney and my CPA yesterday because I meet with them at least every quarter. But right now this year, I'm going to be meeting with them every month because I got so aggressive at the end of last year, taking all my write-offs that I'd been, because I bought a lot of artwork back in 2006. I bought $2 million worth of artwork for $300,000. Because I bought collections that I promised I would never sell on the open market. And the two artists said, then we'll give you major discounts. Well, after 3 years, I've been able to donate that to museums and universities. And when I do that, I get a write-off the full appraised value. Well, my wife's telling me if I donate any more of the art, our home is going to start looking empty. She wants to keep everything that we have at this point. So I was like, do I want to buy more art or not? Because, you know, so we were just sitting there talking, but the number one strategy we were looking at is a shifting of my income into intellectual property and a separate entity. Because if you live in a state that has high state tax, but you do business in all 50 states, you can actually set up your own. It's called the one I'm looking at. It's called a wing. It's an income grantor defective trust in Wyoming That means any client I have that's not a Utah resident, I can filter through Wyoming and not pay state tax. So that's, you know, there's just so much out there. It's fascinating. And it's like, I guess I'm a geek and a nerd for this kind of stuff.
No, that's awesome. You can tell your passion and excitement for it. And that's so cool. And I think that's what rubs off on people, you know, when you're talking to them and meeting with them and everything. So do you guys then have your own team that does all this, or do you outsource those pieces to help, you know, the entrepreneurs, or how does that work?
So we have our internal team, which is our coaches at Wealth Factory. I'll just give you the names. We have what's called a financial architect. They navigate the whole process. They're like a financial quarterback. We have wealth engineers that say, how does this apply to you and your life, and what's your vision? Where do you want to go? So that the individual drives the plan. Then we have something called a results facilitator, which just looks at pacing and when things need to happen. And those are our internal team. But our external team is called the Accredited Network. We don't own their businesses, but we have a highly... It's just a vetting process where it takes at least 9 months for someone to become part of that, where we have attorneys, accountants, investment advisors, cash flow specialists, every type of risk management and insurance professional. And so they work with our organization, even though they own their own company. And that way it feels like a more seamless process. And we can kind of bring what the highly affluent get with the Rockefeller style family office and bring it to the high income working wealthy that don't have huge net worths, which are called business owners.
Awesome. And so then they'll have access to that whole network based on your guys' validating, you know, who they are, and you, hey, we know they're not going to screw you, rip you off. And
we communicate with them. We train them. They were just out in January for 3 days of training. Basically, they're going to communicate with our coaches and give second opinions, because sometimes when people work with us, they keep their existing people because they're doing a good job. That happens. There's always someone doing a good job, but there's always pieces completely missing or pieces completely broken. And now, rather than just us giving advice, these individuals can come in and get the implementation done and save people a whole bunch of time.
No, that's awesome. And I think as entrepreneurs, you know, we need to start looking at, hey, how can we better take advantage of what's here right now, as well as, you know, hopefully with all the administrations and some of the new stuff that they're going to roll out this year, you know, will help us as, you know, entrepreneurs even more.
Yeah, I mean, they're proposing going from 7 different marginal tax rates down to 3. That's massively simplified. Right now, the top bracket's 39.6. They're proposing going to 25% at the top and going to a 15% corporate tax. That could mean a pretty big infusion of cash. And that's, by the way, part of the reason I took so many write-offs last year. And now I'm being really deliberate about tax strategy, because there's two things everyone should really consider avoiding with taxes. And I think when I was in Cleveland, I was talking to you about this. Number one, don't just spend a dollar to save 40 cents or 30 cents. Don't let the tax tail wag the dog. Spending doesn't always make sense. I had a guy that called me in December after starting to work with us in November and said, hey, you know, I'm getting the information for your tax guys, and my accountant's telling me, hey, it looks like you had a good year. You owe an extra $259,000, or sorry, $251,000. He's like, what do I buy? And I'm like, what would you buy? And he's like, nothing if it wasn't for this tax bill. I'm like, then we're not going to buy anything. We're going to start thinking strategy. And in his case, we just moved to accrual accounting to move it to the next year to buy us some months. And we actually were able to handle all but $2,000 of those taxes over the next, you know, 13 months, which was really cool. But the second thing is, a lot of people believe deferring tax is a good idea. I think this is one of the worst ideas ever, because if you defer into an unknown future and we have a $20 trillion debt, that reckoning might come and be a higher tax in the future. So you think you're saving because you pay less tax today, but you didn't save tax, you delayed tax. There is a major difference. So don't just delay unless you have a really clear and good exit strategy. Don't spend unless you would have spent otherwise. And then obviously, if you're going to spend otherwise, be strategic of what your timing you're spending and making sure you maximize your tax deductions.
Cool, man. That's some awesome insights overall. Hey guys, make sure you play this back, take notes, and start planning, start trying to figure some things out, and ask your CPA some of those hard questions that Garrett's talking about, and see if he knows. I mean, a lot of times they're not experts in that area. They can still prepare things for you and submit it and all that, but you need to leverage, you know, and find the right people that are going to help you in your business and your overall personal life reduce or eliminate, you know, different tax pieces, and find those other areas of revenue that are just, or cash that are just sitting there, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And if we do giveaways, I'll give away a tax guide where they know what questions to ask their tax professional. so that they find out if they have the right person or not.
All right, excellent. So tell me real quick, what was three life-defining moments for you?
Life-defining moments. So June 9th of 2006, I'm getting up in the morning to do kind of my morning ritual, and my home phone rings, and I'm like, I don't even know my home phone number, Josh. I was like, I actually didn't even know what was going on. I'm like, what is that weird sound, right? So I just ignored it. And then all of a sudden it stops. I'm like, cool. And then it starts ringing again. So I pick it up and it's my business partner. He's in LA and he says, hey, our company plane left St. George last night with our two partners, Ryan Less, in it. And we haven't heard anything since. The plane had actually crashed into Utah Lake and they died. And so it was a big defining moment for me for two reasons. Number one, I made this mistake of saying I'll do everything it takes to preserve their legacy. What I didn't say was, even if it's at the expense of mine. And so for the next 4 months, I gained 22 pounds. I had a son that was born April of 2005, so just a year earlier, that I never saw because I got up at 5 a.m., drove to Utah County. I lived in Salt Lake County, so it was about an hour drive. I did a two-hour day radio show every single day, 5 days a week, and was trying to run an organization. We had 42 employees, yet half of our partners were gone. And we didn't fire any of them. And I hemorrhaged $250,000+ over that 4 months. And the defining moment came when, I mean, I had all the display of wealth because I'm driving to my hometown in a Bentley. Now, where I grew up, they probably thought it was a Chrysler 300, but I'm driving in this Bentley and I'm sitting next to my wife and we have our best conversations on road trips. And so I've been working tirelessly and exhausted. Even the day before we were taking this trip, my assistant came to me and said, hey, you're double booked for the next hour. What do you want to do? And I was like, oh man, I don't know. I was so exhausted, Josh, from just like, you know, trying to keep this thing together. And I didn't even give her a good answer. I could give 100 answers right now off the top of my head. It's a pretty easy solution. But at that point, I was just overwhelmed and exhausted. So I'm driving in the car with my wife. We're going through this great canyon, Spanish Fork Canyon, big mountains, really pretty. I was teaching English in Korea when I was 18, and I remember that's the place I missed, was driving through that canyon. So I'm in a decent place this day, like, great, I'm taking a day off for Thanksgiving. It's Thursday and Friday and maybe the weekend. And my wife's telling me I'm an extraordinary radio show host and business guy. And I'm like, God, this is great. Then she goes, but you're just an ordinary husband and father. And I was like, oh, damn, that hurt. You know, I was like, and so that was a defining moment where within 6 days, I gave up one of the divisions of my organization, started to spend time at home. And it was the first time I realized, I'd heard a lot of speakers say you could have it all, but I didn't ever believe it. But actually that experience was the first insight to having it all, to living wealthier, to enjoying it. Because when I spent time with them, I got all this renewed energy and I wrote Killing Sacred Cows in 30 days where I'd been tinkering with them for 2 years before that. Because they would go to bed and I'd still be energetic because I was spending time with my family, taking care of my health. I dusted off the damn treadmill, did some Tabata runs on it, you know, stuff like that. So kind of a long story for the first one. That was the defining moment for me. The second defining moment was I took this assessment in 12 areas of my life. It was the Lifebook Introspect Assessment. In two areas said it was my health and it was my marriage. I was average or just above average. But everything else, I was like at the highest levels. And it was like, damn, that sucks. It hurt. And so I was like, what am I going to do? And I figured out that in my areas that I was dialed in, like business, there were certain things I was doing every day and every week that I wasn't doing any of that. Like I had a vision for my business, 1 million entrepreneurs to economic independence, change their financial future and their family's destiny, right? And create a legacy. Like I was clear about that. But if you're like, Garrett, what's your vision for your marriage? To be a good husband. What does that mean? You know, like it was so vague. So the epiphany was I said, all right, I want to be a premier romantic and an extraordinary husband. And this is what an extraordinary husband means. And what I did was I took everything I was doing in my business and started applying the same principles of success to my marriage. So I said, who are the most successful marriages I know? And I actually got those three couples together with my wife and I. And I said, what are your best practices? And will you help us through this? And then I bought 10 books on marriage and two were phenomenal. Eight were okay. And I started reading them. I hired a guy named Dino Watt that had a thing called The Business of Marriage. And I'm like, cool, I pay attention to what I pay for. And I have mentors in business. Why not my marriage? And so I did the same thing in my health. And that was the second defining moment. And then the third one was when I was in kindergarten. I'll make it short, but I drank my chocolate milk, and then the teacher said, make that a milk carton house. And I thought it was the most brilliant piece of art that I'd ever done. The replica of my home, which was brown, in the chocolate milk carton. And then she says, great, I'll give this back to you when you learn your address. And the first day I dinked around, didn't even think about it when I went home. So I came back and mine stayed on the shelf. Half the class got theirs back. The second day I actually stood on my front porch and memorized my address. And I have a slight case of dyslexia, so I transposed the numbers and I didn't get back. Well, the third day, everybody but me has their damn milk carton back, and I'm standing there. And when she's like, what's your address? I got stage fright, and she threw my milk carton away. And I said to myself, I'm stupid. And that was kind of a driver for me to become successful, to prove to myself. But I think when I figured out what really happened in my 20s, and I realized that I wasn't stupid, it was just a story I was telling myself over this stinking little milk carton at a totally different level of freedom and self-expression. And I had this crazy thing where one of my buddies, Gary, said, hey, just talk to that 5-year-old person and tell them it's going to be okay. And he made me get a picture of myself as a 5-year-old and talk. And when I was first talking, I'm on the phone with him, talking to this picture of a 5-year-old. He's like, 5-year-old doesn't know what the hell words you're using. Those are too complicated vocabulary. I'm like, shit, this is the most uncomfortable I've ever been, and you're making me do this. I start breaking down like a baby crying, talking to my 5-year-old, saying, it's okay, I got this. We're okay. We're swimming. You know, and like, and my wife walks out, sees I'm bawling. She's like, what's going on? Like, is everything okay? Like, she, you know, not used to seeing that. So, you know, there's 3 defining moments. I didn't know, you know, you might not get people that specific, but pretty damn specific 3 moments for me.
No, that's excellent, because I think it'll people resonate with that, and you know, everybody has those different ones in their life. And you, one of the things you mentioned though too, and we're almost out of time, is you kind of have those morning rituals. You know, what are some of the ones that have worked well for you that have either put you on the path of success or have kept you, you know, in that space you are now?
Man, when I had my radio show, I would ask people, almost everyone on the show that was really successful had some type of morning ritual. So I start typically by meditation. So I just get up and meditate, and that's the beginning. Second is I have a gym in my house now. I used to go to CrossFit, but my wife's like, you're going to hurt yourself, old man. You need to stop going to that. So I have a programs designed for me, and I just go down and do workouts in my gym. And on days off, I might do a little bit of stretching or, you know, do the roller or some stuff like that. And then third, I go and write in my 5-minute journal and then write a thank you note. And that's kind of my morning ritual, is to start with that. When I'm really dialed in, I might listen to something on personal development or read my book. But honestly, I get seduced into listening to sports talk radio instead of doing that half the morning. So that's the reality of what happens, even though my intentions are the other side. So
that's awesome. Well, cool. Where can people find more about you, your business? I know you said you mentioned that you had a giveaway as well. So tell us a little bit more. A
couple cool giveaways. So wealthfactory.com/tax will kind of help you, you know, with the questions to ask your tax professionals. You can go to wealthfactory.com. But if you want specific resources, you can go to WF Resources. So wealthfactory.com/WF Resources, which are everything from, you know, our investment scorecards, so you can find out if investment's in alignment with you, to our cash flow guides for entrepreneurs. So there's just a lot of cool free stuff for you to get to know us and us to get to know you. But, you know, I have my newest book. If you want a copy of that, you can text 801-396-7211, 801-396-7211. It's called What Would the Rockefellers Do? So you just put in the subject line, WWRD. The download is on me. But if you want the book, I'll buy the book. I just bought 5,000 more copies because we're completely out. I'll buy the book for you if you'll pay for the shipping, and I'll send you the actual copy and get that in your hands. So 801-396-7211, and it's WWRD. So.
No, that's awesome. That's really cool. So we got a book, and we got some different tax questions, everything to ask. So I appreciate that, and I know our audience is going to definitely love that as well here. So what, maybe one last thing you want to leave everybody with, either a life success point or business or whatever you feel that they really need to know here.
Look, this is key. We know as business owners that we should have an A team. And if you have A teamers, business typically goes well. But look at your financial life and make sure, do you have full A teamers, and are you completely covered? Because Cornelius Vanderbilt had more money than the U.S. Treasury, and 54 years after he died, the first Vanderbilt died broke because they didn't have an A-team in their financial life. The Rockefellers built a Rockefeller family office, which was their own A-team, and they're on their sixth generation of that estate growing, of donating a ton of money, and having a whole bunch of wealth. Having an amazing financial team is one of the most strategic advantages I think you can have. And don't just think that earning more solves all problems. Keep more of what you make and plug the leaks and be more efficient with your dollars.
Phenomenal, man. Hey, Garrett, I really appreciate your time today. It was an honor to have you on Making Bank and sharing your insights and just some definite awesome tips and strategies for our Making Bank audience. So thank you again.
Well, thanks, man. And can't wait to see you at the next workshop, event, or you know, things that way. So always good to hang with you.
For sure. I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.